The White Plague was named for its most conspicuous symptom. The skin gets paler and paler and paler. And as it does so, the person loses their appetite, loses weight, loses vitality. Eventually, they start spitting up blood. And over a period of months, maybe years, they just gradually waste away and die. The White Plague was the leading cause of death in Europe for many, many centuries. There's evidence of it back as far as 9,000 years ago. In more recent centuries, it was called consumption. Medical interventions of the day were mostly useless. You know, bloodletting, leeches, purgatives, exercise, just seemed to have no effect on it. And since nobody knew how to treat it or deal with it, it was the source of the disease was seen to be personal. It was most commonly thought to be a symptom of poor character, or of moral, lack of moral strength. You know? And so this allowed people to think if they just went to church and prayed a lot and, you know, led a good and vigorous life, then they could avoid this this terrible disease. Meanwhile, in the 17th and 18th centuries, one person in four, 25% of the people in Europe, died of white plague, of consumption. When we don't understand something, we tend to take it personally. Notice that. Well, this evening I'm actually not interested in talking about the White Plague. Wanted to talk about dependent origination, but I thought the White Plague sounded more interesting. But before we go into the details of dependent origination, I wanted to step back and get a broad picture of what dependent origination is all about by looking at this question of why did the Buddha draw this map of dependent origination in the first place? And the reason he drew it is because we tend to personalize things that we don't understand. You know? When we see things objectively, we don't personalize them. When we don't understand them, we take them very personally. And the White Plague and consumption and all that is a real clear example of that. This proclivity to personalize things seems to be, as far as I can see, it seems to be wired into us, perhaps by evolutionary forces.
But how does that relate to making it, a lot of times, make it the other person's fault?
Well, that's the other thing. You know, it's either my fault or it's their fault. Shame or blame.
Okay, but yeah. That's still personalizing it.
Yeah, because the source of it wasn't me, it wasn't them. It was something else. But so it's personalizing or it thrusts out onto someone else. So to see how it's wired in, we can see in ourselves all it takes is just a string of bad luck. You know, a tree limb falls on a car, you tear your pants, the boss walks in a grumpy mood. And the tendency for a lot of people is to look at the sky and say, what did I do wrong? Why are you picking on me? We tend to think it's about me, myself, and mine, or projected out there. It's their fault. Just to give us a little bit of slack, I think one of the reasons we personalize so much is because we are the absolute center of the universe that we experience, right? Everything I know or I've ever learned comes in through these senses or through my thoughts. Right? So when there's something going on, and it seems to be painful or difficult, and I can't understand why it is, well, I'm the center of this universe I experience, so it must be my fault. Meanwhile, in the late 19th century, the true cause of the White Plague was discovered. It was this tiny little bacteria, the tubercle bacillium. Watch out. Warned you. Don't take it personally. Pardon?
Half of this room didn't take it personally.
So you're taking your enlightenment very personally.
You saw it coming.
Yes, okay. That's right. So you understood it before it happened. So today, of course, we call the White Plague tuberculosis. Right? And since we understand how it works, we don't take it personally. At least I don't imagine those little bacteria are conspiring against me. And since we see it more objectively, we can deal with it more effectively, both to prevent and to treat it. This tendency to take things personally happens even when the situations aren't frightening or disturbing. Life is going okay. Your partner is okay. The kids are doing just fine. But life feels a little flat, a little gray. So the most popular diagnosis for this ennui is that I have lost touch with my life's purpose. You know, there's something I'm supposed to be doing and I've lost track of that. Right? We hear this all the time. It implies that life has given me a secret mission. You know, it's something special I'm supposed to accomplish. And so if I want a sense of aliveness, I have to figure out what my special mission is and go out and engage it. So when I find myself reflecting this way, I like to think about the Hubble telescope. In the fall of 2003, scientists pointed the Hubble telescope at this patch of sky southwest of the constellation Orion. It was a patch that, for all we could tell, was completely empty. And it covered an arc, a span that was one-tenth the span of the full moon as seen from Earth. And for 3 months, they focused this ultra-sensitive equipment into this little tiny patch of sky, and they compiled all the data into a photographic image they called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. You can find it on the internet. And in that little empty patch of sky, they discovered 10,000 galaxies that no one had, not stars, 10,000 galaxies that that were completely invisible to us before. The average galaxy has about a billion stars in it. Scientists estimate now that the universe has a minimum of 70 million, million, million stars. That's 7 with 22 zeros after it. So the question is, how many of those stars have planets that could support complex life? The estimates, using all kinds of methodology, run from about 1 in 5 to almost all of them will have a planet that is not too hot, not too cold, has the right mass, so it could possibly support complex life as we know it, even if that was 1 in a million. That's still a lot of planets out there. So it raises the question, what is the chance that there is intelligent life out there? Probably pretty close to 100%. And what's the chance that we humans are the most evolved species in the universe. Pretty close to zero. Arthur C. Clarke, you know Arthur, he's a science fiction writer. He said once, "I'm sure the universe is full of intelligent life. It's just been too intelligent to come here." So when I think that my life has a special mission or special purpose, I like to go outside on a clear night and lie down and gaze up into the heavens. There are billions of galaxies, billions and billions of stars, and probably millions and millions of species that are more intelligent than me. So here I am, lying on the edge of this planet, circling a kind of nondescript yellow star, thinking, and I'm living a life, you have to remember, that lasts about an eye blink compared to the 13.5 billion years the universe has been unfolding. And I'm thinking that all the forces of time and space out there have assigned me a special purpose in life. How narcissistic can you get? Yes, I, you, and me, we all arise out of this. We all arise out of this universe. So I think that there is a way that we can find to live in harmony with all of this. I mean, we're all made out of stardust, quite literally. You know? The complex elements in our bodies were formed inside the cores of stars that exploded. So we're actually part of all of it. But if we want to be in harmony with all of it, first of all, we have to see what the truth of this is. And the truth is that I have probably been not chosen out of the 9 billion people on this planet and the hundreds of billions of creatures amongst billions and billions of stars for a special mission and purpose. It just seems silly to think that. Unfortunately, this silliness causes an incredible amount of unnecessary suffering. The Buddha said that the primary reason that we suffer is that we take life personally. We take it personally. So to relieve our suffering, a part of this whole formula is to figure out some way to break this narcissistic trance that we've gotten caught in. Yes, we have a self that we experience, but it is not personal. I'm sorry. Our sense of self is not personal, and it is not separate. It's not separate from this flux and flow of life. So, how could the Buddha, or anyone, convince us of something when all our wired-in instincts tell us otherwise? Unfortunately, just using straight logic, it is almost impossible to prove that something doesn't exist. Logically, it's almost impossible. Does that make sense? So if I believe this building is infested with tiny, intelligent aliens from outer space, and you wanted to prove that they aren't there, probably the best thing you can do is take me by the hand and walk me through the whole building, and if we don't find any evidence, that just proves to me what I've always known about these tiny space aliens, that they are very, very good at hiding. So the lack of evidence, all that proves that there's lack of evidence. It doesn't prove that tiny space aliens don't exist or that I don't have a self. Right. So, to go back to the White Plague. People stopped thinking that tuberculosis was personal, that it was a moral disease, when they found a better, clearer explanation of the phenomena that we identify with self. So to demonstrate a lack of self, first we have to experience, not just understand, but to experience a more plausible, more compelling experience of all these phenomena that we call self. Most people identify, if you ask who I am, what I think of is, well, I am, you know, this collection of memories and inclinations and feelings and thoughts and sensations. And that's usually what most people think of themselves. Unfortunately, the laws that govern how the sensations and thoughts and feelings and consciousness and all the rest of that operate are so subtle and so complex that it's more difficult to see those than it is to see the little tuberculosis bacteria. Very, very hard to see this because there's so we almost don't have the brain power to compute the complexity of all that. But to experience it, what we need is a mind and heart that is clear, that is quiet, that is aware, that is free of tension and distortion, to see into the exquisite subtlety, particularly about how thoughts and feelings and how all that stuff moves through us. And what happens is that when the mind and heart are clear and quiet enough, that the whole system begins to shut down. And then when it comes back online, there is a moment of clarity when you can just see the truth. It's just right there about how things are. The Buddha called this, in Buddhism, it's called knowledge and vision of how things are. They call it yatha bhutanya nadasana. That'll be on the quiz tomorrow. See, I hope you got that. There's this moment of just seeing a clarity of how things are, and it's like, oh, wow, there it is. That's what it is. I see it. And at that moment, the identification with the personal self is gone, and suffering stops. It's just gone until the narcissism starts back up again. But to even get a tiny glimpse of that begins to weaken, you know, the identification with that personal self. It's one of the first signs. So the Buddha taught a collection of attitudes and exercises that can cultivate this wow experience in a deep and enduring way. And to help us cultivate this experience, he drew this map of dependent origination as an essential part of it. It's the map of dependent origination is the real backbone of this whole practice. So if you remember that when people didn't understand how tuberculosis worked, they took it personally. When they understood it, they didn't take it personally. And so that's what the Buddha was after. If we understand how the mind-heart work, if we can see that directly, we don't take it personally, and it frees us up. You know, as I listen to myself describe it, it sounds a little almost supernatural. You know, it feels like so exquisite, almost impossible. And there is this element in Buddhism and of the wonder of it all. And some of that mystery has been filtered out as it's come over this country. But there is that. And what it's about is that clarity is actually attainable. It's a lot closer than we imagine. So how do we do this? Utejaniya, this Burmese meditation master, who's one of my more recent heroes. He said that to talk to Westerners about non-self, he said it was just futile. In Western society, the idea of individualism is so deeply embedded in the mindset that he said it just seemed to be confusing to people. And so he doesn't talk about selflessness. He goes to the other end of the spectrum. He just says it's all natural. Everything that happens is just a natural process. Bhante Vimalaramsi takes a similar tactic, but rather than say natural, he says it's just all impersonal. Everything happens because it's impersonal. So the Buddha, to help us cultivate this impersonal, this experience of these impersonal natural processes, offered this map of, it's called Paticca-samuppada, the laws of dependent origination. I kind of like the sound of Paticca-samuppada. Paticca-samuppada. That's going to be on the test tomorrow, too. The laws of dependent origination, what they refer to is the laws about how everything has its origin and a cause, and that cause has its origin dependent on something else. It's this whole string of things. But before we go into it, it's important to understand that the map is not the territory, and it's really only a map. The territory never looks like the map. Right? It's very different. But what the map can do is it can tell us where to explore, where to point our awareness. You know, the map says, look behind that rock, or take a look over that hill. And it's up to us then to look behind that rock or look over the hill. So the map can direct our awareness, but it's important not to confuse the map with the reality. So later on in the retreat, I want to talk a little bit more about the phenomenon of self and non-self and what I'm taking to call the infinitely expanding self. But tonight, as I said, I want us to just focus in on Paticca-samuppada. And Paticca-samuppada has an incredible amount of little details. And some of you are taking notes, and if you try to write this down, you just go crazy. You run out of pencil lead. So this is your cheat sheet. So what I'd like to do for the remainder of the evening is I want to read some passages from the text to just give you a sense of how dependent origination... Thank you. Of how dependent origination actually appears in the text. It's really kind of dry, but I think having... a little bit of familiarity with the source material is actually helpful. So I'll read you a passage, and then I want to give, because the passage describes the map. It doesn't describe the territory, it describes the map. And then I want to give an example out of real life. And then we'll look at how this shows up in meditation and how to use it in meditation. So feel free to interrupt me as I go along. I'd much rather have a dialogue than a monologue. Sure.
This really throws me when I see this reference to consciousness. Is there a separation or a distinction between whatever right that is that? You could bring everything down to the most common denominator. What is really me is just this speck of awareness, and that there's no personality and not male and not living on earth, and I mean all this business. But then I've seen the text consciousness, and I struggle to understand, is the Buddha saying that even that speck of awareness, that is dependent upon something else and erases, and I can't conceptualize that, or is it saying that, or is consciousness maybe a poor translation saying, does it really mean something other than what I think of consciousness? Is it more like this phenomenon, this perception that exists? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's actually difficult to answer because different teachers answer it differently. I'll give you my best shot at it.
Okay.
Is that the consciousness has different meanings, and I think vijnana here, what it's referring to is actually awareness. But even vijnana is used in different ways. So vijnana also appears in the skandhas, the aggregates, as a fifth one. And there it clearly refers to thinking, thought, storylines, concepts, etc., etc. And clearly here this is pre-concept, pre all of that. So it is quite confusing. My best understanding of the way to see it is actually potential. That there is a potential. We're really getting down into the... all these things are actually from contact, from the sixth one, that's where ordinary perception comes in, but it's actually possible to experience these earlier ones directly. And the sankhara that come before that, when I experienced them, I didn't know what I was seeing. But there was this very, very faint impressions that just kept on reappearing, almost sort of like a little dream, but it was very consistent. And I talked to Bhante about it, and he said, oh, well, you're seeing sankhara. And what it appeared to me was the sort of image was that coming up out of nothing was like this ball of energy that just was coming, whizzing past me in my sort of internal field of vision. And my sense of it was it seemed like a stem cell, that it had the potential to be all kinds of different things. It wasn't one of those particularly, but it was something. Like a stem cell is something, but it has the potential to be all these other sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So I think the formations and consciousness are kind of like that. It's where stuff comes in and it hasn't. You know, as I saw this, I said, well, it could become an elbow, it could become a thought, it could become all these different things. But it hasn't become that yet. So you've seen it before that. And it arises right straight out of ignorance, out of not knowing. So I don't know if that's helpful. That's as close as I...
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a different kind of question. Which I would be very excited to have a response about, which is I think that self and identity are, in fact, words for conceptual... descriptions of the person's tendencies, their preferences, their style, whatever it is. And therefore, it would never be the description of a thing.
Right.
It's a description of a set of attributes that this body or whatever
right.
term is the object of it.
So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if I can stop that line because I want to pick up on all of that at some other point. And see if we can get back in, but it's a
nothing to disagree with
right.
what this is about because I experienced that
right
so,
yeah. Yeah, okay, so do you want to hear some text?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
From which
sutra? I'm going to read this. This is from the Discourse on the Many Kinds of Elements. It's the Majjhimagaya number 115. And I'm not going to read the whole sutta. That would take a long time. Starting at verse 11, the Buddha gives an abstract description of the formula for dependent origination. He says, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist... that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. And, okay, so you get, it's very stylized and it's repetitive, but all those are actually important. So with dependent origination, it's not something that gives rise to something that then takes on its own existence. It's something that arises, and then when the cause disappears, it disappears. And this is very important when we actually look at what goes on in meditation. Because what we're doing a lot in meditation is relaxing the causes that give rise to further links downstream. So then he goes on to give the specifics. And sometimes Bhante was doing this. We'll do a little bit call response with this. So your job is to fill in the blank. And I'll read the first couple of them. So this is how the formula works. He says, that is, with ignorance as condition, formations come to be. If you can find that on your little sheet there. Okay? So with ignorance as condition, formations come to be. With formations as condition... Right! with consciousness as condition... comes to be, yes. With mentality, materiality as condition? With a sixfold base as condition? With contact as condition? With feeling tone as condition? With craving as condition? With clinging as condition? With habitual tendencies as condition? With birth of action as condition. So there's this whole long string of similar kinds of miseries and different flavors of miseries. So that's the thing. So this is how dependent origination is actually described most often in the suttas in this order. Yes. Right.
Similar.
Yeah, and yes.
It makes it easier for me to understand it because it's something that happens all the time.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You see it all around. It's cause and effect.
Yeah. It's just, sometimes, you know, it's like you put a seed out there, you go, oh, nothing happened, and then you come back and it's like, oh.
Yes. Right. Yeah, so there are multiple causes and conditions. That's why it's so difficult to see this stuff, is that if teaching your child how to make the bed was a cause and condition of having to make the bed, well, that isn't true, because sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, so there's something else going on. So what actually happens with dependent origination is there are hundreds or thousands of things that converge, and that's why it can drive you nuts to try to figure it all out. But this breaks down to just the core elements, and you'll see these in meditation. And I'm pretty much convinced that the Buddha didn't teach anything that didn't have a direct application and some usefulness in this project of figuring out how to alleviate suffering. And so when he's given this, he's actually looking at the things that are very useful in meditation. Because people ask him questions about all kinds of things, and suddenly he just refused to answer because he said, you know, it's not going to get you anywhere. So dependent origination is usually, I call this the downstream flow. It's usually how it's presented, but in meditation, where it becomes most useful is actually reversed. So this is an example of how it's explained in reverse order. This is from the Discourse on the Destruction of Craving, the Destruction of Tanha. This is Majjhima Nikaya 38. And this will be a little more challenging for you to find off the list, but he'll pick it up. So with the cessation of birth of action comes the cessation of aging, death, and the whole mass of suffering. With the cessation of habitual tendencies comes the cessation of birth of action, right. With the cessation of clinging, comes the cessation of, right. With the cessation of craving, with the cessation of craving, right, the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of feeling tone comes the sensation of, with the cessation of contact comes the cessation of, with the cessation of the sixfold base comes the cessation of, with the cessation of mentality, materiality comes the cessation of, with the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of mentality, materiality. I gave it away. I'm sorry. With the cessation of formations comes the cessation of, with the cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of, okay. So do you have all that down? It's a lot to absorb. Bill has got it down, so.
The quiz
on it tomorrow. He's going to ace it. Okay. So let me move from this abstract sequence into an example. And this is similar to one that I actually used in Buddha's Map and may be familiar to you, but I'll just tell this little story. So I open the refrigerator one morning, and there is a serving of flan. And I really love flan. And so I think, that would be wonderful, but not for breakfast. Okay. So I go off to work, and but this idea has been planted in my mind, you know, and so I think about it on and off during the day, and you know, how good that would taste, and that's wonderful, and I'm going home, and I'm thinking about it, and I walk in the house, and I'm thinking about it, and I open the refrigerator, and there it is, and I take it out of there, and I hang a note so no one else gets it as I get a spoon, and I scoop up some flan, and I put it in my mouth, and there is this moment of just absolute bliss, right? It's just wonderful. And if you're like me, it lasts, what, 2-3 seconds, right? And then the sensations fade a little bit, and I think, oh, I want some more. So I go for the next bite, and I get the next bite, and there's that little blast of bliss, which the second time maybe lasts a half a second. And so I go for the third bite, which there's no little blast, but it's pleasant enough, so I gobble it all down. Okay? So, the question is, where does that moment of ecstasy come from when I get that bite? What causes that? And the gurus of the advertising industry will tell you exactly what causes it. I got what I wanted. Right, I was hankering for it all day, and so I got what I wanted, and therefore I'm happy. And we have built, you know, in America, in our quest for happiness, we have built lifestyles and economic systems and entire culture on this philosophy that says getting what you want makes you happy. We have become so proficient at satisfying desires. Flan, ice cream, hot tub, designer clothes, luxury cars, evening at the theater, varieties of chocolate, 300 cable TV channels, beds with personalized comfort settings, vacation packages, books, musics, and on and on and on. Right? Our technologies for producing comfort surpass anything that the world has ever seen before. We are the gods on Mount Olympus. But are we happy? Are we really happy?
Short memory.
Short memory, yeah. Most of us actually spend more time trying to earn money to buy the good life than we do enjoying it. You know? Crime and violence abound. You know, these days we don't even like to let the children play alone, unattended, out in the neighborhood. You know, there's... depression affects an estimated 3/4 of the population. Alcoholism, teenage suicide, diffuse anxiety, on and on and on and on and on. So, what's the matter up here on Mount Olympus? You know, there's something must be wrong. So let's go back into this example and unpack it a little bit. So in this little story, all day long I was longing for Flan. Well, the longing actually is not happiness. You know, it's a yearning, it's a grasping, it's unpleasant. In fact, it's so unpleasant that what I do is try to take my mind off of the unpleasantness. Right? So I may fantasize, you know, how good it's going to take to have that Flan. Right? Sweet anticipation, we call it. And it's a little bit unfortunate. Actually, it's a lot unfortunate, because wisdom can only arise in the moment, can only arise out of real, live, present moment awareness. And when we have our mind off somewhere else, there is no room for wisdom to come in.
It's much better to eat
while
first thing when you see it.
That is another philosophy. So what we end up doing with all this stuff is actually fantasizing a lot. And we may not think that, but if you look around, if you just look at the entertainment industry, it is massive. Movies, TV, sports, you know, books, on and on and on. All stuff that's designed to distract us. So, wanting isn't pleasant. But that first bite of Flan, right, that first bite, that seems genuine, doesn't it? Yeah. But you want to get it right away before it gets away from you. Yeah. So it's important to look at what actually goes on during that moment. So when I put the Flan in my mouth, what happens is for a moment there, my desire evaporates. It's completely gone, because I don't want the Flan anymore, because I actually have it. And then, of course, what happens is the sensation fades a little bit, but what we do in our culture is we focus so much on the object of desire rather than the desire itself, that when it fades, rather than look at what's going on our side, we actually go out for the object again. So we go for more and more and more. We confuse the absence of desire with getting what we want. Right? It's the absence of desire. It's not the having. And they seem to coincide. But I love the way Lao Tzu put it. He said, you're rich when you know you have enough. But if you're always focused on the object, you never know how much enough is. Because there can always be more. There can always be more. Eat Flan until it's painful. Most of us have figured out a long time ago that material items doesn't give us lasting happiness. So we look for experiences. You know, a little bit of Flan, you know, maybe taking a movie or hot tub, have sex, go for a nice walk. And so we end up going from desire, desire, to comfort, from item to item, until we are worn out, exhausted, and dying of stress-induced diseases. Right? So ascetics and fundamentalists have realized a long time ago that having stuff doesn't make us happy, so they try to get rid of it. But in my eye, when I look at them, they seem kind of grim. So having stuff doesn't do it. Getting rid of stuff doesn't do it. So what is there left? What is there left? So let me just walk back through this, my little story here, and we're going to put dependent origination on top of it. Okay? So the story begins with the opening the refrigerator door. There's light that reflects off the Flan, strikes my eye. Right? Buddhism gets down to these little details. And so with awareness, there is raw sensation. And in Pali and the pendant origination, that's pasa. That's the sixth item there. So it's just the raw sensation. There's no thought. There's nothing. It's like if you hear the sound out there, there's just a sound before you label it bird. Yes.
In Buddhism, is there a label for what comes prior to that, the motivation to go to the bridge?
That's actually further down the line. There certainly is that motivation. That's called tanha. It's grasping. Pardon? Yeah, it's sort of tanha literally means thirst, so it's kind of a hunger or thirst. It's kind of a wanting, and in the classical descriptions, it's usually associated with a specific object, but there can be wanting that's just diffuse. You know, sometimes we want something we don't know what it is. You know, there can be that, but that actually comes later. That the wanting doesn't come up until there is first. Well, I'll skip ahead. We'll just walk through it. So there's the raw sensation, and then the raw sensation can be gives rise to a feeling tone. Vedana, it's not an emotion; it's a feeling tone. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay. In this case, looking at the fawn seems pleasant. And if it's pleasant, we tend to lean into it. Want more creates desire. If it's unpleasant, we tend to push it away. Creates aversion, anger, ill will, all that stuff. And if it's neutral, we are so wired to look for pleasant and unpleasant that if it's neutral, we tend to just ignore it. And the result of that is ignorance or confusion. Okay. So there's the raw sensation, there's a feeling tone, and the raw sensation will give rise to a feeling tone, the feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. The feeling tone, in turn, gives rise to a desire or an aversion, which is the wanting that you're talking about. And up to this point, all of this is pre-verbal. Okay? And if it continues to flow, then what happens is the craving, the aversion, the tanha, gives rise to a thought. The mind kind of shrink wraps around this desire and gives it a label. That's called upadana. It's called clinging. Clinging, I think, is a little confusing as a translation. I tend to keep going back to the Pali because sometimes the terms just don't translate. But upadana, clinging, always manifests as a thought. So you're sitting in meditation, and this thought comes in. It actually has a little bit of tension in it. That's the upadana, that's the clinging. And the thought will trigger a whole string of bhava, of habitual tendencies. It'll set off a storyline, a concept, a bunch of ideas. Sets off a bunch of thinking about it. And the thinking can give rise to action, and the action can give rise to suffering.
So craving isn't thought-based?
No, it's not. It's pre-thought. It's pre-conceptual. In English, craving may be thought-based, but but tanha is pre-thought. It's like... So you're driving down the highway and a car pulls sort of in front of you. And what happens? Hands tighten on the steering wheel. That's tanha.
But that's vedana, isn't it?
There's the unpleasantness, but the actual, you know...
I mean, the vedana is the initial unconscious recognition that, you know, there's a problem. That the feeling is it's something unpleasant. So then the craving then, you know, the pushing is, I would think that that would be entering into the thought process at that point.
Well,
what, you're going, oh, heck, I'm going to hit this person's bumper.
Yeah, no, it happens. So, yeah, so my experience of it is that somebody pulls in front of me and the hands just tighten. And then I may have a whole bunch of thoughts about it. The difficulty with this is that these links can happen very, 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 very quickly. And so it, you know, so subjectively, somebody pulls in front and the first thing we're aware of is this whole thought. You know, we're swearing at them. But there are these tiny links, and what will happen in meditation as the mind gets quieter, you'll begin to see those. And the force that runs through all of those is tension. So there is a little bit of tanha in each one of these phases. So there's the contact, the raw sensation, which is just sight, sound, smell, with no thought, no nothing. And if that gets a little bit of tension in it, then it becomes pleasant or unpleasant, or maybe neutral. If it gets, and if the vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, if the tension in that is not released, so this is where 6 R's come in, right? Let me just skip ahead and let me just walk you through this in meditation. I seem to be doing that anyway. So, and then we can come back and we'll flan some more. Okay. If you put a T on the end of the world, you'll be you'll lose a point on the test. So you're sitting there meditating, and let's say that this is your object of meditation, okay? And your awareness is just resting on it, and it's very quiet, and everything is groovy. And then the next thing you know, there's this thought storm. Why is he always saying that? What happened? Why? You know, we used to be such good friends, and now he's turned his back on me, and I don't know. Oh, I was meditating, right? You know that place. So you're sitting there, and suddenly you sort of wake up, and you're in the middle of this thought storm. And so sort of recognize thinking, release it, relax the tension inside it, smile, and then bring the awareness back to the object of meditation. And maybe a few minutes later, it's like, that guy's such a jerk. Why is that? Oh, you know, so maybe this goes over a couple of times, you know, release and relax and then come back. And then the pattern becomes familiar. So you're sitting there, and what happens is you become aware of the mind. There's this word jerk. And before the whole string of thought about what he did and all the other stuff get started, you recognize, release, relax, re-smile, and come back. So the whole string of thoughts doesn't go out there. So you're back there. And then the word jerk comes up again. You know? And so you keep 6R-ing that. And then you begin to recognize jerk has quite a charge in it. And so you'll be sitting there meditating, and you'll just feel that the charge will come up. There'll be a tension. Pulls you off the object. And before it even becomes a word or anything, you 6R it. You just see the tension. Recognize, release, relax, smile, come back. And then you'll be there, and there'll just be a vague kind of, you know, everything feels wonderful and smooth and serene. And you may notice a little bit of unpleasantness. And you can actually 6R that. Recognize, release, relax the tension in it, and come back. And, of course, as you're doing this, what happens is the amount of time that you're spending on the object of meditation gets longer and longer. And the amount of time you spent lost out there gets shorter and shorter because the mind is getting stabler and stabler. And then you're sitting there, and what happens is you'll feel the mind just starts to wobble a little bit. And you don't know what's going on, but you just 6R at that wobble right there, and it stabilizes. And then you're sitting there in the mind, you just notice a little bit of vibration. Just a little bit. And you 6R that. At this point, it's not 6Rs, it's just one kind of swoosh. And then you wink out. And you go into nibbana and you come back and you say, wow, that's how it works. Okay.
Okay, let's go.
Right. How come the arrow?
The number.
Okay. So what? So they're numbered differently. So on the first side, it's how dependent origination is usually described. It's the downstream flow. What happens, as I was describing it, so you go over here, there's, you know, he's a jerk, why he's doing all that stuff. Those are habitual tendencies. And then the jerk is the clinging, is the first word that appears there. You know? And then the tension that you feel underneath that, that's the tanha. And then there's a little bit of unpleasantness. And then there's raw sensation. And we can go down from there, but those are harder to see. But if you can just get those.
The reverse way, you won't have that delusion, instead you have that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so that's why there's a space there. That as you release, it actually goes back and back and back till everything ceases, and that's when you go into nibbana. And Bhante said to me when I was seeing formations, he said, look, if you can just follow, because they seem to come out of nothing. He said, if you can just follow that back in there, you go into nibbana. So I thought, oh, goody. And that was enough tension to prevent it ever from happening.
But what's nice is your description of how the actual specification of the content disappears, so you notice that there's a ripple of tension.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to do anything very active, because doing an aggressive 6Rs gets you back into
it puts more tension. So tension is the stuff that drives the whole thing, because that's what you're doing. You know, you notice that with a 6Rs, you're releasing that tension. And so I put the little model here, the Russian dolls, on there, because this is my other model of dependent origination. It's this collection of Russian dolls. So, you know, on the outside, you know, you start off with suffering. And inside suffering, it's not that when you relax the suffering that you the action is already in there. And inside that action there is the tanha, everything else. It's just you can't see it because these other things are much grosser phenomena. So as you relax them, it's like peeling back these layers.
And so that's why this only happens at the levels where you get really still, because otherwise there's too much going on.
That's right.
Very minimal cues to actually get
your consciousness. Yeah. Well, I'll say it. That as you have touch into some of those experiences of deep quiet, you begin to able to actually to recognize those, even when the turmoil is there. Once you have a feel for them, but it's a feeling. You can't get there conceptually, but once you know the experience of it, it's possible to sense it even in the storm, and that's when you can begin to feel the layers. And when that happens, the layers peel off faster and faster. Unless you want them to peel off faster and faster, in which case they just get thicker. So
are you saying that nibbana is, it almost sounds like there's varying degrees of nibbana. There's sliding in and out of it, and then there's what we typically think of, like, this exalted final you are done state that's kind of permanent. Are there different nibbanas then?
No. Nibbana is nothing. It's nothing.
It's the.
It's It's nothing. There's no feeling. There's no consciousness. There's no nothing. And so nothing doesn't change. But so it's the metaphor I like for it most, it's sort of like if you had a laptop computer and somebody pulls the plug out of the wall, the whole thing shuts down. And then you plug it back in and it boots itself back up, maybe with a little bit of malware that's not there anymore. That's what Nibbana is like. Everything shuts down and then it comes back online. And so then you go in again. And so there's this process of going in actually many times. It's not into a different space. It's just it just clears it out further and further and further.
I think he was asking about the stages of stream entry.
Yeah. So the first time it happens is called stream entry, which... different teachers, I had a teacher who put it this way that was really intriguing. He says, stream entry, that's enlightenment. Because one of the things that happens that stream entry is actually enlightenment. Because what happens when you come back, it's not only see that clearly, but you see clearly, I know what I got to do. You know, you see all this thing work, and any doubt that you had is gone. Unless you're like me, I'm very good at doubt, and as I move away from it, it comes back up again. You know, but for a while there's absolute certainty. That's enlightenment in the sense that you see what your path is. Liberation is when you've completed the path.
When
you've done what you needed to do.
There's two other terms that I see often in this stream entry that I'm confused about. Path knowledge, brute knowledge.
Path knowledge and what?
Path knowledge and brute knowledge.
Okay. So, shall we walk through all of these? Okay. So, there are, in this is traditional. I'm not sure all this actually goes back to the Buddha. Bhante would whack me with a rule. No, he wouldn't do that. But traditional Theravadin talk about four stages. The first is the stream entry, is the first time you go into Nibbana and come back out. And what happens with that is that there's for a moment your identification with a separate self is just severed. It's just gone. But all the associated stuff with having a separate self is still all wired through our neocortex, so all that other stuff is there. So it kind of comes back in. I love to quote Gurdjieff on this one. He said, once you have a taste of truth, you can't fool yourself quite as sincerely. You know? So this stuff comes back up, you know, but there's a place inside that doesn't quite buy it. And if you spend a lot of time not practicing, that can actually degenerate. And you can actually lose it. So with stream entry, they talk about two phases of it. The first is the attainment. This is what you're referring to. And the other is the fruition. So the attainment is actually when you first experience something. And then as it goes a little deeper, the fruition, it kind of stabilizes to the point that you're actually not going to lose it again. And my thinking, and some of my teachers would say that stream entry and liberation are the only thing that are really important in this. There are these gradations in between that are talked about, which you can actually experience, but how much import to put on them. So, stream entry, breaking of the identification with a separate self until it comes back online again. They also talk about one thing that happens is a loss of belief in rites and rituals. But I think what that really is that you see through your cultural conditioning. You know, the stuff that you understand and you don't buy it anymore. Another thing they say about it is that you can't break a precept. But I think that's that's a little bit of an exaggeration, because many of you have experienced degrees of this already. You notice as the practice goes deeper. Did I talk about this the other night? I can't remember where I talked about this. So as the practice goes deeper, so for example, you know, they have the precept about not lying. Well, so you'll feel the impulse to lie to somebody, and what'll happen is that'll come back to bite you somewhere down the road. And, you know, maybe it's a normal person that takes a while for that to come back, but, you know, with a stream entry, it's like you can feel, okay, you know, now I'm going to have to keep track of what I said, and you can feel the tension and all that stuff. And so the motivation to actually break a precept, it's not that you can't do it, it's not there's something magical that prevents you, it's just the motivation, a shot for it. You can feel the blowback from doing something that's harmful to somebody else, so it just gets harder and harder to do that. And it can be quite tangible, but it's not quite black and white. But I think all of those are just actually a byproduct of having the sense of a personal self, just having been, you know, it's, I don't know, the Wizard of Oz, like you see behind the curtain once, so wait a minute, that's not what it looks like. Many of you may have had the experience, I had for a long time before I even started this practice, of I just realized I don't even believe my thoughts anymore. You know, why would anybody ever believe their thoughts? So you kind of see all of that stuff. Then what happens as it goes deeper, the next stage is called Sakadagami. And the the mythology that goes with it is with stream entry is that you can come back. You can incarnate as many as 7 different times. That's tops before you'll be fully enlightened. And I think you have to look at numerology and that these numbers were not taken literally. It just says there's something that's very complete about this. And in my best sense of it, it feels to me it's like going over continental divide. It's like the game is over. It's just a matter of time. And this lifetime, if you believe in further lifetimes, it may be down there, but there's a certain momentum that you really can't go back on. You can try, but it just doesn't work. Can't fool yourself quite as sincerely. With a Sakadagami, which is a once returner, means that you can come back for one lifetime. But the characteristic of that that's most important is that desire and aversion, it's like they're cut in half. You know, they're still there, but they just don't grab you like these. You can feel them a little bit, but there's this kind of noticeable drop. You know, and you see all your friends are going out to a movie, and well, that would be okay, but the sort of magic has gone from it. It's not that it feels terrible, but there's just a lot of of those strong pulls are just attenuated.
So the flan is like, maybe I'll give the flan to somebody else.
Yeah, or like, that's wonderful, and that'll be gone for a minute, and so what? You know, it's like seeing the whole process. It's you're not enchanted by it. Quite so much. There can still be the desire there, but that you don't actually buy into it.
But at one level, the real bottom line is that if somebody gets stream entry, unless they continue to meditate on a regular basis, they might retain it.
Yeah, you can lose it. It's hard, but you can actually make yourself go out and drink beer and pillage and. But it's hard.
Giving the flan to someone else can be very happening.
Sure. Yeah. And that will arise and pass too.
You can watch immediately. So let's say they're
There's four. So there's the Sotapanna, the stream entry. There is Sakadagami, or once returner. There's an Anagami, which is a non-returner, which means you can go into other realms, but you're actually not coming back to Earth. And then there's an Arahat. And each of those four have two parts to them. There's the attainment, and then there's the fruition. And the fruition is when it solidifies. So you can attain one of those, and then you can slip back from it. But once you get to fruition, it's this is how they're described.
So this is referring to the compulsion to take rebirth. It is not an extinguishment of, again, back to that differentiation of consciousness versus that speck of awareness. Is that correct?
Yeah.
In other words, if you don't ever take rebirth, do you just like kind of roam around the canvas, the universe checking stuff out, or is there a universe and that's just something we can't conceive, or like what's... I get that there's pain and suffering and birth and death, and that would be cool to lose all that, but then what do you do with your time?
There is no more you. It dissipates. So the way you can think of rebirth is there's like this collection of energy, you know, that comes in, which has some tension that holds it together, you know, and you know, comes into a body, and then that body dies and it gets another one, you know, and goes on. That's what the rebirth is, and what happens is there is some tension that keep that mind stream together, and as that gets relaxed and released more and more and more and more. Eventually, the whole stream just dissipates. Did I talk about whirlpools in here, or was I talking about... I talked about some of that. I live near the American River in Sacramento, and I love to walk along there. And there's all these... There's this one place where I go... where the river goes down, and there's this little inlet, and so the water comes down and catches in that, and it flows back upstream, and then where the two pass, it creates all these whirlpools. And they're really fascinating to look at because, you know, a whirlpool, I mean, you can measure it, but what is a whirlpool? You know, the center of it is actually nothing. It's just this energy that's spinning around and around and around and around. And then as they drift out of this stuff, you know, it slows down and slows down and slows down until the energy in it doesn't disappear, but it dissipates, you know, out into the river itself. All the water that was in the whirlpool is still there, but it dissipates out there. The only thing that's missing is the definition of the spinning. So that's what happens to you is, you know, it dissipates, and everything that was real remains. But the pattern is lost. It's like a sandcastle. You know, you have the big sandcastle, all the stuff, a wave hits it. The sandcastle is gone. Well, actually, everything that was real is still there. All the grains of sand are still there. It's just a form of it. Whatever it is that held it together is gone.
So to ask a really stupid question, it's not, for example, if somebody died and was terrified of dying, that terror would then suck them back into reincarnation. It's that there's a whole system of stuff that's as yet unprocessed, which constitutes craving and which drags the person back into reincarnating again.
Yeah, well, they're both of those.
Both of those, yeah.
Yeah, both of those, that, you know. And again, we're getting into kind of slippery area because, just because you're asking about it, but, you know, what the Buddha said is that you don't have to believe anything you don't experience. So these are not the beliefs. So this is how the tradition comes down. The Brahmins around at the Buddha's time were very, very involved in rebirth and how many births and what's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, I think with the Buddha, there's a stream entry, and then there's... And then the text, when you see it, the description of the liberation is that, you know, the holy life has been lived, what needs to be done has been done, there's no more work to be done, there's free. But all these in-between stages, I think, were probably imposed, kind of leaked in from the Brahmin influence, who were very interested. Well, if I get this far, what I think of is the martial arts, And they, you know, in Japan and China, the traditional martial arts, they have a white belt and they have a black belt. You started teaching it to Americans, and you get, you know, a green belt and a blue belt, and they have all these sort of levels in between, and so you want all these measurements so they can measure where they are. The traditional thing is you either do it until you're done, and then you're done. And I think these in-between stages could have been. I don't really know.
There's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's called the Eight Kinds of Noble Persons. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha was asked about what are there noble persons in the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And he goes, yes, there are eight. And then he goes through and just lists them and tells the qualities of the eight. So it's there. And then anybody who's not one of those is called a padujana?
I don't know.
Is that right? And that's
a worldly.
Worldly.
Yeah. Or we might say earthling. No, it's worldly. but it's important if you look at the history of how those suttas were compiled. Most of them, you know, were several hundred years after the Buddha, something as long as 500 years before they're in their final form. If you go back to the very earliest text, the fourth book of the Sutta Nipata is probably, it could have even been written down during the Buddha's lifetime. There are no four noble truths, there are no eightfold path, there are no five hindrances. There is just this guy. How much time do you have? Do you want me to read you a short one from there?
Yeah.
It has a really, really different flavor. There's just this guy who is obviously quite charismatic and who is stumbling around trying to figure out how to describe what he's experienced when there's not the language for it. And you can see, if you read through those, you can see all the later doctrines that arose out of it. They're all the elements that are in there, but they're not stylized, put in these things. And in the I'm glad I brought this out with me. And in the Sutta Nipata, maybe I said this the other night, there's maybe, I don't know, it's 20% of them start with lines to the effect of, I wish you guys would just stop fighting with each other. If you had any wisdom at all, you wouldn't argue. So you can sense what's going on. And in the Sutta Nipata, there actually is no Sangha. This was probably very early before the Sangha actually gathered. There's just this wandering recluse. And Yes. But, you know, the Sangha took a while to form. This is a lovely translation by I want to give you the reference to Leslie Fowler. Lipkowitz, Tamara Dietrich, and Primoz Pimsenko. The three of them are Aussie, and there's a few Aussie lingo that comes in here. They are deep, deep practitioners and scholars of this stuff, and one of them is a poet. And that's what really shines through this. What usually happens... Oh, you got me going here. I'll just tell you one of my stories about translations. It's the fourth book of the Sutta Nipata. It has four books. The Metta Sutta is actually in the first book of the Sutta Nipata. The one that's... So when some of you heard this, I apologize, but for those of you who haven't, when Purdue Chicken went into Mexico, he took their slogan that had been very successful in the United States, it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken, and they translated it into Spanish and posted it around. But unfortunately, in Spanish, it came out meaning it takes an aroused man to make a chicken affectionate. Make a chicken affectionate. And so, you know, if you look at this stuff, you know, words don't translate from one language into another because the words have different clusters of meaning. And so what happens with the scholars when they're trying to translate this is they'll take a single word and they will try and they'll put it in a whole long phrase because they're trying to get all the nuances. And then it gets really cumbersome, so it's hard. But this, they worked out with a poet that actually folded a lot of the meaning back in, but with an economy of language. I have three other translations of this. All of them have about three times more words. I think it's from Pali, which is an interesting story in and of itself. Yeah. I won't read the whole thing, but just to give you a flavor of it. The response to violence is fear. This is the Buddha talking. I'll tell you about the dismay I felt when I saw people hurting each other. They struggle like fish fighting in a dry creek, and I was scared. The world's not stable. Everything's in flux. I wanted a place to be safe from the change, but there was nowhere. In the end, I was disgusted by their hostility. That's when I saw the barb work deep into the tissue of their hearts. When the barb pierces someone's hearts, she runs first one way, then another. When the barb is drawn out, she neither runs confused nor falls down weary. Remember, don't tie yourself to worldly bonds. Go beyond desire. Practice for your own realization. Tell the truth. Be modest and open. Speak kindly to people. Don't yell at them. Be wise. Avoid grief and selfishness. Avoid greed and selfishness. Okay, so you get the flavor of that? He talks about being scared. There are some people who are... what hasn't been done with the suttas is to go back deeply into them and unpack all the influences. So, for example, some of you may know this. In the Bible, there's the school of German literary criticism, which, you know, in the 1900s, they went back and started to take the Bible apart to see which phrases in there that may be attributed to Jesus or somebody else, but clearly came from the particular author of that book. Other ones that clearly came from the early church and its ideas. And then what's left is the stuff that might be traced back, you know, to Jesus. And that stuff is very humanistic. What hasn't been done with the suttas is actually do that kind of unpacking. For example, during the 100 years after the Buddha died, there was a lot of competition amongst the various sanghas over who's, you know, my guru is better than your guru. And so there's some speculation. There is this one sutta that describes, the quest, in which describes Buddha's, Siddhartha Gautama's training. And he goes to Alara Kalama, who had this whole big sangha, and he trained with him for a while, and he mastered everything Alara Kalama had. And Alara Kalama offered to teach with him. And he said, no, there's more beyond this. And he goes on and comes to Ramaputta, who's another one who has this whole big sangha. And with that, he masters Ramaputta's stuff all the way up through the eighth absorption jhana. And Ramaputta offers to step aside and turn the whole sangha over to them, and he refuses, and he goes on and eventually becomes enlightened. So there's some people who are looking back at this, and so here's this period of time when some of these texts were being compiled, and they're competing for devotees, you know, for come to join them.
And support.
Support from the community. So here, you know, our guy was Siddhartha Gautama the Buddha, and here is Alara Kalama, who we know from other texts had a huge, huge following. Well, our guy mastered everything Alara Kalama mastered, and offered to turn the whole business over to him. And so did Ramaputta. And so, you know, what's the sociological sort of political, you know, effect of those things going out? So how much of that can be traced back to that story, can be traced back to what the Buddha said, and how much of that was layered onto it by other people who were compiling this, who had you know, a mixed agenda? And we just don't know. We just don't know. But the people who are starting to do this, one of the criteria that they use as to whether something might be genuine, and they don't know, but it's just sorting this out. One is whether, if the Buddha says something that might not be flattering to him. Because none of these people are going to pass, are going to make up something unflattering to talk about him. So the Buddha says here, I tell you about the dismay I felt when I saw people hurting each other's. They struggled, etc. I was disgusted by their hostility. I was scared. That doesn't elevate his standing at all. So from the scholar's perspective, they say that actually puts a couple of checks on the column that says this might be genuine. Because why would they pass it on? Somebody wouldn't make that up about him. Why would they pass it on unless they heard? Pardon?
Because the PR department
Right.
So I know in some circles where I'm talking about a scandalous, but I think, so when I look at these suttas, you know, I get as many translations as I can. And I look at my own practice and what I know. And I read the different texts, how different people have translated it. And then I try to think, what is it that Buddha could have been actually saying that got translated in all these, or translated or mistranslated in all these different ways? And then with some of that, you begin to be able to feel back into what may have been coming from that. And it is a lot of work, but what I can say, and Jordan and I were talking about it just last night, is that as painstaking as that is and time-consuming, there are times when there are just little gems that just sort of rise up out of that. But it's not easy going because, as this one scholar I've been training with says, you know, that we're on the receiving end of a 2,500-year game of telephone. You know, what somebody said, what somebody said, what somebody said. And it's amazing to me the amount of wisdom and clarity that comes through it, despite all the other stuff. It's I just think this guy must have been just absolutely incredible to have it survive all this. And a couple of nights, I'll tell you about another big distortion that comes in all this. That's just a teaser. I just wanted to...
Okay.
I was afraid, so I'll get y'all to come back. So, questions about dependent origination or anything else?
I have a question on the, you described about the stream entry, and then you mentioned a few attributes like destruction of identification of self and other things. So are they coincident or are they like gradation after the stream entry, you get into those things later on?
So, you're sitting here meditating over a number of years, and that you find over that period of time that it's harder and harder for you to lie, it's harder for you to take something that's not freely given. And so you describe this to other people, and they concretize it and say, with a certain level of attainment, you know, this is no longer possible. Part of it, I didn't want to get into that. Well, we'll get into it more later, but it's actually the predominant consciousness of the time tended to be more black and white rather than seeing these gradations. And so there's a tendency. You also have to remember that a lot of these texts were memorized and passed down orally, And so a lot of the stylistic stuff comes there just to make them easier to memorize. And so they really got codified, you know, for those purposes. And so for those reasons, they get really stiff, which is why, you know, when I can, if I can get back to these really early texts, and you get this whole different flavor of what's going on there. So so there are 10 fetters that are described, and there are 5 that are supposedly severed with stream entry, and then the 2 that are weakened, and then those 2 are gotten rid of, and then there are the final ones when you become an arahat, fully enlightened. And I think those are... in the book I use the image of a river for dependent origination, because this place and this place are clearly different, but the distinction between them is actually gradual. And I think that's what happens. So I say that, and at the same time there are very deep and profound and tangible effects that you can feel. And how they play out in different people are a little different. Full awakening doesn't necessarily clean up all your psychological conditioning. You know, it's not working that stuff out. It's a point where that doesn't matter so much anymore. You're not there, but it doesn't clean up. You know, so how this stuff manifests, you know, in different people, and it's not that a full enlightened being would be, acting out neuroses and stuff, but. That's why I get in trouble with the Bhante, but I look at, there are many suttas where the Buddha is given a talk and Mara shows up and the Buddha says, "I see you, Mara." And so Mara is described traditionally as a being, you know, who is the, not quite the devil, but, the trickster delusion. And so in modern terms, you know, Mara is a metaphor for delusion. So the Buddha is there giving a talk, and a delusion arises in him. So he's a fully awakened being, and there's delusion there. The difference between him and us is that he sees it for what it is immediately. So he's not fooled by it for a moment. Most of us, we get caught. And one way of describing this whole process is the amount of time that you get lost in illusion, just get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, you know, until it disappears. But there are some tendencies that are just wired into us biologically. And I think the one about a sense of self, I think, is wired into us biologically to think that way. And so as long as we have a body, there will be that tendency. The difference between us and a Buddha, an arahat, was that they see all that working, and they're just not fooled by it. They're just not fooled by it. So they're, it's a long roundabout way to get at your question, but there's all these nuances that I see. Okay. Was there a part of your question that I missed?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Oh, the higher path. I was trying to get a complete thing of all this stuff about dependent origination. Dependent origination is usually described in these upper ones. Although actually in the text sometimes there are 12 links, sometimes there are 13, sometimes he describes 9. There's whole different numbers depending on how we're breaking it down. The higher path, and it's described as dependent origination too, is actually how... the awakening unfolds up to, actually all the way up, but, it's pretty obvious going up to stream entry. And it seems to pick up where, you know, at the 12th link of the other ones, sorrow and grief. So down at the very bottom, there's suffering. Suffering actually... It gives rise to faith. And so there's some missing steps in there. What happens is that there's suffering, And so you take on some kind of practice to deal with the suffering, and you find it works. And then you develop some faith in it. That's what they're talking about. So there's some missing steps there. And the faith can lead to, you know, a sense of relief. It's like, okay, there is this stuff, but, you know, maybe there's something I can do about that. And out of that comes a joy and a tranquility. And in different places, the joy, the gladness, the joy, and the tranquility are given in different orders. But there's the tranquility and the happiness there is actually a very deep kind of happiness, which leads to samadhi that Bhante translates as collectiveness. And this, many people translate it as concentration, but it's a terrible one. So mind just gets very, very stable, and it feels very collected. And collected is, I found, is a very helpful term in meditation. It feels a little jarry in the language, but in terms of the experience. And then out of that collectedness, you begin to see this knowledge and vision of how things are. And as you see that, it it's not fun. You begin to see all the futile ways that you have tried to improve your life that just don't work. And that's called disenchantment. And the first time I ran into disenchantment, I was in Thailand, and the practice was to give us jhanas, that acknowledge us. So we were supposed to sit down, and every day before I started meditating, I would say, Kamayata jhana arise in me. And I asked Ajahn Tong, my teacher, what Kamayata jhana means. And he says, I'm not going to tell you. That would just confuse you. So I didn't know what it was. But I sat down with Kamayata jhana. As soon as I said it, I started crying. And I just cried and was deep, and I had no idea what it was and until I was exhausted and I fell asleep. And then when I got to meditate, I cried more. And just went on and on all day like that. And I went to this other monk and asked him, you know, what's going on here? And he says, oh, you know, I used to get that. And I got out and I just tried to run from it. I ran across the rice fields and I ran and ran and ran. And then I realized it's going to follow me everywhere. So it's not going to have to go. So I went back to meditate. And so when I finally got into my interview the next night with Ajahn Tong, you know, he wanted to know what was going on. And I was desperate at that point. And the interviews were very formal. But I was going to get something from him about all this. And so I described what was going on. And this was going through a translator. And he came back with one question. He said, do you feel restless? And I said, restless? I feel like a caged animal. And he said, good. This is the next one that I want you to work on. And I went back to the chair and said, wait, I need some help. You know, this is really terrible. What do I would do with this? And he gave it was the sweetest little smile, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, that's just Kamayata jhana. You know, when you do this next one, it'll be gone. And he leaned over, and they have in Thailand, they call it drinking yogurt. It's this liquid yogurt that's sealed in boxes so they can microwave, so it doesn't need refrigerator. And he had a lot of these that people had given him. So he picked up one, and he gave me this in the story and says, this is your reward for doing so well. You'll be fine. And I walked out of that interview kuti, and the despair and all that stuff was completely gone. It was like I walked out of a trance. Well, that was a disenchantment. You know, later I found out that was the one I was bringing up. It was the disenchantment. You see just what a mess you've made of your life. And it is necessary because when you see that deeply enough, you start to develop a little more dispassion to what's going on. And then the dispassion leads to the full liberation. So that's what the upper path is. They're very different in that the upper ones are described in there, the lower path, if you will, as we were talking earlier, those can unfold in an instant. You can go from contact to feeling tone to a tightening to a platform just in an instant. these unfold slowly. But as your practice deepens, you will go in and out of these. But this is how they how they line up.
So, I mean,
Sandy had a question over here. I wanted to get to.
Just curiosity, you say they won't come back and they don't have rebirth. So where did they go?
That they will come back, but they won't be. So an anagami, they say, will not come back into this world, but they may be born in one of the Brahman realms.
And how about...
How about you? Me?
Arahat.
The Arahat? Oh, they're just gone.
Yeah.
Their mind stream just dissipates. Yeah, it's just gone.
Dust, dust in the air.
Yeah, metaphorically. I think one reason people don't talk about this so much is that, you know, it's when you start this meditation, that was not quite the image of what you had or where you're going, you know, to be hit by a, what was that, the Klingon disruptor beam, you know. Pardon? You would prefer to come back. As long as there is a preference for coming back, you will come back, according to this cosmology, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That goes on and ends. So something that you've done with your energy will then continue on and go into another body.
Right.
But then you talk about remembering past lives. So it seems like there's something more that's more detailed there. It sounds more like a soul or something. You actually remember.
That's just the way we think of it. I think of them as like a line of dominoes. You know, when hits Nick, and this one falls down. So you start in this like, and here's something in this life. There was no entity. There was no Paul Revere on horseback, you know, riding down to deposit this in the next life. There was just this cause and effect. There was just this kind of chain reaction. Yeah, and so some of that energy is passed along. And so... yeah, I say I have memories of past lives, the way I think of it is that they are memories I inherited from somebody else, and I'm just trying to clean the mind stream up to pass it along a little cleaner to the next one. I just want to be very clear that you don't have to believe any of this. It's really your own experience that counts. It was very clear that what the Buddha saw was vast compared to what he actually shared, because he limited it to what he thought would actually be useful. And so a lot of this stuff he doesn't talk about so much in that, but there are later traditions and people around where this stuff links in. And he did a lot of taking existing ideas and adopting them with a subtle twist.
For those good people, they just despair. No wonder this world has more and more bad people, because those good people.
It could be. It could be. There's actually. We don't want to get off into this, but I don't know if any of you have, if you've read, what is The Better Angels Over Nature? He does an incredible job of documenting. He apologizes at the beginning. And what he's actually documenting is how the world has actually been getting better and better.
And those people, if we could encourage them to come back, this world could be better.
Ah, yeah. But they would have nothing to do here. You know, we come into this world because, I don't know. My sense of it, if you push me on this and quote me on this, I'll disavow ever saying it. But my sense of it is that we come here because we have something to learn. If we are... you know, in a place where everything is taken care of and it's just beautiful and wonderful, there's no motivation. to actually to evolve, to grow, to mature. And if we are in a place where the conditions are just horrible, you know, if you grow up, there are hell spaces on, you know, on Earth. If you grow up in a war zone, you know, or someplace like that, it's so terrible that there's no freedom to actually evolve yourself. And so they talk about this world as a place where there's actually a mixture of the suffering and the possibility. So there's enough to get some inspiration to work, and it's uncomfortable enough, you know, to get us off the dime and get us moving. And so with this system of understanding, if somebody has learned everything they need to learn from here, then they don't have any, there's nothing to come back for. And it may be nicer, but if we made this world nicer, then all of those people who need world with this level of stress would have to go somewhere else. And I don't know if that's true, but that's...
I think also we're recording stories of all the mistakes so that we can learn from other people's mistakes because it's written down, so it's easier for us to do a little better. We're lucky for the all the angels that have left and left us good stories.
Right, right.
So, yeah, the, so I'm afraid you've stigmatized... disenchantment, that it doesn't necessarily need to
transpire
in the way that you experienced it. So everybody's different.
Right.
I just wanted to
good.
Clean that up.
Good.
I got the notion there.
Good.
There's a distinction between the retrospective view, the disenchantment of your past, but you were talking in terms of the prospective despairing that any more attempts.
Yeah, no, it's I'm a Taurus, you know. I'm a slow learner, so I will own it. I always learn things the hard way, you know. So for me, I kind of need to be hit over the head 3 or 4 times with a frying pan for it to sink in. And you know, when I was first training with Bhante, it sort of became a joke that you know I would. Get this wonderful stuff, and then I'd say, Bhante, you know, I fell off the horse. You know, 3 or 4 days where I'm just back, you know, grinding through stuff. And then, okay, that would clear. So so people do go through it differently. And I put myself as an example of a Taurus because we're known for... we actually aren't stubborn. We're just patient waiting for other people to come around to our point of view. But it comes in with a certain sort of built-in resistance, which actually just amplifies it. So I was getting my karma back. But there is some of that disenchantment which can be disheartening. And I also know people who have actually gone through it really lightly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That
I
just, yeah.
All
yeah.
of it. All degrees.
Yeah.
It's just a stage.
Yeah.
Yes, and also, I mean, you said that you had a very long history of depression
right.
for many years, so there's bound to be a huge amount of disenchantment. And when the guy said about you being a slow learner, not that you were a slow learner, but that you were still fascinated with it, that you wanted to find out every little tiny detail of it, how it works, etc., which is what our group is benefiting from down the line as you actually go and teach it.
Checks in the mail. Thank you. Yes.
How does habitual tendencies seem in the meditation? I understand tension is the example for craving and thoughts for clinging. How about
thoughts, storylines, ruminations? It appears as all those. Thoughts and ideas and concepts and stuff that are, and they're called habitual tendencies because when we look at them in our mind, they seem, it's nothing, you know, habitual, it's just how things are, but actually how, what those ideas are and how they unfold for us has a lot to do with our own conditioning. Bhante sometimes calls them habitual emotional tendencies. So there's a lot of the emotions that get caught within all of that.
So what's the difference between clinging and habit tendencies?
Between clinging and
habit tendencies.
Clinging is just the first thought, and it'll trigger this whole thing. And if you can catch the first caught, then the rest of the first thought, then it doesn't go off. But it's the trigger that starts it, and the clinging. Like I said before, that it's really pre-verbal and it's kind of nebulous. With clinging, there's also that tendency to label, and it becomes defined or over-defined, concrete.
Yeah, really the invitation for us is to see what's happening in our experience,
right,
and to not be scared or freaked out or shamed by that experience, so that we can actually then open to it.
Yeah. I just wanted to check and see if I had any other just short things. You'll notice in the text there are no links. There are no links. The word link does not appear in there. They were always described the way they're in the text. When this arises, that arises. So the linkages were a later thing. And you also notice there's no wheel. There's no wheel. The Tibetans oftentimes put dependent origination, ignorance, so it goes around like that. But in this, the suffering doesn't necessarily lead back there. And this is the way he described it. What that was, I think, is a conflation of the wheel of samsara with dependent origination. But there is no wheel.
Each of these arise in one moment. So there are sets of these arising in moment to moment. So before, I think there was a question earlier about what happened before, what triggered the opening of the refrigerator.
Right.
So looking at the refrigerator and all those craving and clinging associated with it triggered the opening of it. And then, so there was like these sets of these happening at
right.
the moment.
Yes.
And they are linked to each other by how one set manifests and the next set.
Right. Right. And the reason I'm a little hesitant about the word link is because it makes them sound like discrete entities. The sense of when you're feeling it's more like a flow of energy. And and you can be in not just in stage 2 but in stage 2.3, and there's these gradations between all of them that and how they unfold.
One of my teachers teaches it as it's an antecedent event. That is, they happen simultaneously. And it's as if, so he gives the metaphor, it's if you're in an absolutely dark room and you turn on the light and the scene happens immediately, and yet there are two activities. And so he talks about teach
you
samapada in the same way that it is simultaneous and
antecedent. Yeah. Sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it could be. Yeah. And the things about the what leads to what is that you can see, in the example you gave there, that there are hundreds and hundreds of things that come together, to make any particular event. And so in any real-life event, there's a lot of those. And what's important is the ones that when that ceases, this thing disappears. Okay, how you doing? Is that enough?
I have a question. Jordan, what is our weather like tomorrow?
As of earlier today, it was supposed to be just a slightly cooler than today and overcast, or somewhat like today, except a little cooler.
And what was today supposed to be like?
It was supposed to be warmer than it actually was. Overcast and 89, I think, but I don't think it got quite that warm.
It's the temperature for tomorrow.
Yeah, the temperature is supposed to be less warm than today. I think it was 81 tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Anything more?
So this kind of ties in somewhat with the opinion.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the point of what do you do after suffering is eliminated. Certainly that's the main motivation, it seems, for most of us to be there. It almost sounds like it's almost like an engineering problem. That is, there's cost, and maybe the cost, you can help me out with, the folks here can help me out with, because getting back to that thing about effort, this takes a lot of effort, at least for me. And I don't know that, as people describe meditation as its own, I don't know if that's a good word, reward is the right word, and it's fun to do, it's enjoyable. I don't know that it is, not from my experience. So if there's costs involved, and kind of determine what's the amount of payoff that I'm willing to work toward, depends on the engineering analogy. If you're not driven by some fear of rebirth, meaning fear of more suffering yet to come if I don't get it right this time around, then it seems like death is the final nirvana.
Yeah.
So sounds like a kind of just an individual choice as to how much effort to put in, what you're going to get out of it.
How much suffering you have to go through to get free of suffering? Yeah. There are places, in the practice where I think we all struggle and suffer, but my experience has been over the years it's gotten lighter and lighter and lighter. And if it didn't, I wouldn't continue. So it in the beginning, without that train of experience, because faith is born, quite frankly, of experience. And without the experience of it, there's no reason to necessarily believe that. But if when the practice gets worked out, suffering arises out of tension. You're releasing tension throughout this whole thing. That's part of the Buddha's path. And that puts a momentum, in the direction of less and less suffering. The difficulty, of course, is that all of us have little stashes of forgotten stuff way down underneath there. And as the mind, heart get lighter, some of these old stashes will come out of the dark and come wrap it up, and it's, it can be quite uncomfortable. But though those are already there, it wasn't the practice that created that. They were there. The practice basically is a purification. It's actually trying to find ways to release stuff. And sometimes as the stuff releases, it's no fun. But if we can't get your practice to a place where it's enjoyable, then I haven't done my job.
Is this your first retreat?
Yeah.
So I did my first retreat a year ago, and my day job is engineering problem solving and ROI all day long in information technology. Mm-hmm. So I approach everything with that mindset. Here's the end result. Here's our math. Here's gap analysis. What are the steps to get there? So I'm always looking, okay, enlightenment, cool. What's the checklist? Okay, what are the 10 things I need? I really approached it like that. And what floored me about Bhante is after 20 years of reading about Buddhism and actually doing it, I found a big difference. Where I'm going with all this is my first retreat at Dhammasika, on the first like 2 or 3 days, I was just like, oh my God, what am I doing here? This is nonsense. It was drudgery. It was terrible. Plus, it was in August in Missouri, so it was hot. And I got on the other side of it, it all makes sense. So it was something I said the other day to you, is do the practice, and when you get farther ahead in time, you'll look back and you'll go, just today. I'm not big on faith. I'm very much on objective reality. But I will tell you, my personal experience is, have faith that the steps you're being told to do, you do produce a result if you do them as you're told. Don't try to figure out why they are put together the way they are. Just do the work. The results will come to themselves. That's been my experience.
Put another check in the mail.
Yes.
I'm not going to make anything on this retreat.
Yeah, no, I would come out in debt.
I think it would be fascinating if every single person here just took a little time to describe what their motivation is for following the path, because I think that there'll be a lot of different motivations, but I think that would give you a sort of aggregate feel for what does motivate people to do it.
I think we could if you want to. My intuitive sense is that we're kind of running out of group time, and that sort of people wanting to get back to it.
Yeah.
Do you want to know where you can get a good massage and a foot rub? And
well,
Yeah, well, to just say the obvious is that we are organic systems, and so it's not quite like a bunch of parts. So we're actually cultivating qualities, you know, within this organic system, which will respond in lots of different ways to different situations. I'm sorry for your struggle. And you know, and I'm one who's what kept me going was just a little bit of desperation that I just couldn't see another alternative. And part of my joke with Bhante is that I tell him, you know, I seem to have to do it wrong every possible way, and when I run out of options, then I do it the right way. And it works. And I was like, what's
that?
Yeah.
I was in a lot of pain. And I was like, what's wrong with
me? And the other thing about this specific thing, which is why I'm here, is I've cruised the Buddhist world a lot. I live in my own county, so I've got a lot of different options in the Bay Area. And this is the only sort of corpus of knowledge and information which actually goes into detailed stuff that the other traditions all don't really want to talk about, or don't talk about, or obscure. And it took me a long time to get into Buddhism initially, but gradually, once I'd done that, it became very clear that it was actually true about that one induces suffering in one's own life. And so that's one really big motivation.
So all this is being motivated by compassion for your suffering, right? And there's a certain amount of stuff we have to work out on ourselves. So I think some of these testimonials are actually helpful, but at some point we just have to let people, as Ram Dass said, you know, love is the willingness not to mess around with somebody else's life.
Okay. There's some conversations I'd love to have continue on with Julie, like, for example, continue some sort of discussion with Julie, not necessarily involved in the group. But this precept, it's not one of our precepts to be silent, it's just one of my instructions.
Yeah, it is. It's folded into the wise speech. We could talk about what wise speech is, but it's an incredibly difficult discipline. And in the context of retreat, the best way to achieve wise speech is to not speak.
Well, maybe that would make it a different time. You can maybe you can laugh
Oh, because when our mouths open, our mindfulness flies away. Not necessarily, but statistically, most of the time. Yeah, as we start speaking in conversation and stuff, there are just levels upon levels of social interaction and idea and stuff like that, and we're a society that's very externally oriented, and we're trying to create an environment in which we can actually see deeply into what's going on inside us, because that's where the liberation comes from. And it's been somewhat trial and error to figure out how to create that environment. And there's a lot of collective experience that to conduct a retreat in silence is, you know, for most people is more helpful than talking. So that's another one of those things that I'm just giving a testimonial to, and you haven't experienced it. So, but that's the rationale behind it. That's the rationale behind it. Okay, so are we ready to get on with it? So let's just take a moment. I feel very grateful for all your input and your practice and your questions and just the willingness, you know, to kind of sit with this stuff, because there's lots of uncomfortable stuff that comes up for us, you know, in all kinds of different ways. But just the willingness to actually be with it, to see what unfolds, so we can see a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper. And you guys are doing very well. You guys are doing very well. And so I want to take some of the merit of all this and just have us send out the benefit of it, to have us as a collective send out our well-wishing, the peacefulness, whatever it is that you have gained, and just send it out. You won't lose it when you send it out. It just gets stronger. Send it out to the people and creatures around us, both near and far. May all beings find their way to genuine happiness. May all beings have compassion for their struggles.
No.
May all beings find ease. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings be free. May it be so.